Okay, we think that the idea of being a founder is just for you to come out of school, first class, dreadlocks, 21 years. No, no.
In a continent where innovation meets necessity, one leader stands at the intersection of finance, technology, and transformation.
The business of financial services is first built on trust, then capacity. Capacity. Someone who has not shown that they can own 100 million should not collect 100 million from you to keep.
He is the president of the FinTech Association of Nigeria, the CEO of Zest Payment, a Stanbic IBTC subsidiary, and a man redefining how money moves across Africa.
If I pick up my phone and I open MoneyPoint app and I send to you right now, before I say the word right now, you've gotten the alert. What's the infrastructure behind that Swift service?
From building digital rails for inclusion to starting his fintech journey in Nigeria's northern region, driving adoption where few yet to go. Dr. Stanley Jacob has seen it all.
And they say to me, I've built this solution. I want to do this. I've approached this bank to partner with me, but they say I must bring a license. You are a founder. You built a solution for 2 years. You didn't know you need a license. You understand what I'm trying to say?
In this episode, he reveals the secrets behind OPAY, MoneyPoint, and Zest Lightning Speed transactions, the 100 million Naira fintech license holder, and why investors keep betting big on Africa's fintech gold rush.
There is no one as dangerous as trying to be a driver in a car you don't understand. You understand what I'm trying to say? So you must understand the ecosystem that you are going into.
This is the Frankly Business Podcast, where Africa's biggest minds come to talk money, business, and the future.
There are a lot of gatekeepers. You're one of them. In 2021, we had about 144. In 2022, we had about 200 to 270. In 2023, we had 700 plus. And guess what happened in 2024? It increased to 1,263. The big question is that I need you to understand to hold these numbers in one hand, because the question I'm going to leave you with and ask you about this episode is, does Africa need more payment startups? Now, those numbers are the numbers of fintech apps, fintech startups that we've had in the last 4 years. Now, the big question now is, does Africa, do we need another payment startup? Welcome to the Frankly Business Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, you're very much welcome. This is an oracle of payment joining us on the Frankly Business Podcast. So it's a honor to have you on this episode of Frankly Business Podcast.
Thank you, Frankie. The introduction scared me, but I'm humbled and I'm really glad to be on the show today.
Okay, so now what we see, the light camera action, everyone, we all know that we know you as a CEO of Zest. You built your career, Stanbic IBTC and all that. You've done a lot in the industry, but let us get to meet Stanley Jacob. Now, without the doctor, now without the accolades, without the M&I and all that, let us meet you. What is your value system? How did you grow to become this? Because there are people, young, upcoming founders, young, upcoming fintech rave of the decade, and they are watching and they're like, away from the light camera action, who is Stanley Jacob?
Thank you very much. Stanley Jacob.
Yeah.
I think most people call me SJ. But I'll start by talking about background.
Yeah.
You know, once people meet me out there in the industry, the first thing they want to know is, did you study payment?
Finance.
And when I check, maybe at the time I went to school, there was definitely no course like payment.
Whoa.
There was definitely no course like electronic banking. Hmm. These are modern educational transformation in degrees.
As
at then, what you have is the traditional engineering courses.
Yeah.
The science courses, medicine, and all that. But again, education has seen its own fair share of transformation.
Very true.
Right. So the first thing they want to know, what did you study? But I'll tell you today, I didn't study payment.
Hmm.
I didn't study electronics. I didn't study computer. I didn't study electrical engineering. I actually studied building engineering. And I majored in structures, high rise to be specific.
Wow.
So the earliest part of my career started off in the construction space. And that's, for me, is something I find very interesting. So I still find myself having to do a bit of construction. So whenever I see myself in that space, the early passion gets ignited again. So that's a background for me.
Yeah.
But over time, the quest for personal development has seen me do a lot more things. Has seen me specialize in digital business, seen me specialize in venture capital, seen me specialize in cards and payments. Just as payments continue to evolve in the past 20 years, we've also gotten ourselves built to prepare not just for the issues at hand, but for future-proofing the landscape. So it's been an interesting run for me, having to switch from construction to payment. But when I look at my early roots, tech roots, right, it's a journey from construction to financial inclusion to tech transformation, and all geared towards what we are doing today. So I can say that 90% of all the times in my career, I've spent it in payment. Whether when I was in the bank or not in the bank, in big tech, it's been all about payment. So it means I've spent almost half of my life doing payment. And it's something I'm really glad about and grateful for the privilege. In my early tech roots, when we started some of these things, then the most you can see in payment was ATMs. ATMs was the transformation.
Yeah.
ATMs was the digital.
Very true.
Right? So we almost thought ATM would do everything. You know, there was nothing like cash acceptor and all that. But once you have a debit card at that time, or an ATM card, as we call it, then you are good. You are cool, right? But it was really something very good. And we evolved from ATM to online banking, to mobile banking, to USSD. And traditional banking and adoption of digital continued to evolve until, of course, slightly over a decade ago, we started seeing electronic banking transformed to electronic business.
But before we come into that, sorry to cut you. I want us to have a backstory. What was the inflection point? You made mention of construction. And at what point did you switch? What informed that decision for you to switch from construction to come into payment? What caught you studied construction, like you said, civil engineering and all that. What informed that decision?
So it wasn't a decision that I took deliberately. I think it was more of unintended consequences. So I'll give you a brief.
Yeah, please do.
From construction, my first foray into a bank was to work for a bank subsidiary. I would not like to mention the name.
Okay.
That has a subsidiary called Projects. It's a project subsidiary that was responsible for building branches and rolling out ATMs across Nigeria aggressively at that time. So I had that responsibility across the north.
So it was in the north?
Yeah.
So it was similar to construction?
I was constructing and deploying ATMs and doing all those stuff. And I found myself doing ATMs at the end of the day. And before you know it, I found myself in the mainstream bank. But I think if I'll answer that question about what informed it.
Yeah.
It's about excellence, right? You do construction, you do ATMs, and before you know it, everyone thinks you know everything about ATMs. And I found myself in the bank, and I found myself doing big things beyond just deploying ATMs. And that was how it crossed. And before you know it, I was no longer constructing. I was now deploying ATMs in thousands, actually. It was massive. You know, we are now in an era where the ATM growth has been flat, but then that was the thing.
There's a common lingua. Are you the last person on the queue? Anytime you hear that, you know it's an ATM queue or something.
Yeah, you know that.
Are you the last person on the queue? And Nigerians are fond of that. They will be like, I'm not the last in Jesus' name. You hear things like, you're like, what the heck are you? It pisses the heck out of me because
but Frank,
I'm talking about you being the last person on the queue. I'm not talking about your life.
You know, you just picked on something. But yeah. I'll tell you, at that time, just like today, when you want to open an account, the young guys are saying, oh, I like their mobile app.
Yeah, very
then,
true.
Then one of the key reasons why you open an account is because the bank has an ATM near you.
Very true.
But they say the ATM is just by the corner. So yeah. I open an account. If your ATM is far, why should I get you? So a lot of things. And this is how we've seen how customers' needs, how their needs inform their decision.
So did you think the ATM drove inclusion? Because that is something fundamental for your industry. And it looks like what we always see, I love the fact that we're unraveling that aspect of ATM, and I want us to dwell on that a little bit. What we always see is the fact that we see a lot of businesses, we hear people saying, financial inclusion is the reason why I'm building, this fintech product. But how many of the unbanked are really being included in the financial sector? How many of them? It looks like what we're doing, we're just recycling the banked minority. It's even the minority. How many of the, because it looks like that was the template that the ATM, that was what the ATM was doing. That was the work of the ATM. It was really going into the nooks and crannies, even without electricity, where you have ATM hubs with just solar panel and all that. They were banking the unbanked. Do you think we're still doing that in the industry?
So thank you, Frank. I think I have a slightly different opinion.
Tell
because
me.
I think ATM served its purpose at the time it should. And why am I saying so? When you go to a bank and you open an account, they give you a store of value where you can keep money.
Very true.
The game is simple for an average Nigerian. If I put money, how do I get it out when I need it? And our economy is still largely cash-based. So the ATM was an instrument for me to get cash. There were just two choices then. There was no agency banking.
Yeah.
It's either you are in the branch or you are at an ATM. So at that time, I think for those people who needed a bank account and who needed a store of value, the ATM drove decisions around their inclusion.
Yeah.
So some people opened bank account because they could have a card. You know, some people opened bank. It wasn't even more about web payment. It was about how do I access my money.
Yeah, true.
And I think the ATM played its role before we started seeing pure virtual channels coming up on board.
Yeah.
Of course, you see, part of what the ATM is doing today is what agency banking has done.
That's the POS.
Yeah.
I want us to break it down.
Yeah, the POS. And, you know, it's still about getting cash. So the battle is with cash. The battle is not between the channels, right? The battle is how do we, battle of financial inclusion is a battle against cash. Not necessarily the battle between ATM and POS and mobile banking. I think these are all complementary channels that eventually comes out to help the consumer get the best of experience.
So you're saying the battle, we're a cash-driven economy. If you look at that, we're really a cash-driven economy, especially the rural part of Nigeria. And if I go to the far north and say Zamfara, and I go to one of the remote villages or one of the, even in the southwest, I go to Ado Ekiti or I go to our villages. We all know what I'm talking about. Our villages where we still draw water from the well, where we still use clay pot and all that. Don't you think that we need to bank these guys? Because now it also reflects how the value of our GDP. Transaction happens every day in those places. From the farms, we're talking about farmers. We're talking about different things. There are a lot of value that comes from there. Mining, minerals, bringing out minerals from the ground and all that. These are transactions. These are values, values that cross-pollinate different industries. Don't you think they need to be banked?
Okay, so I think that our story on financial inclusion is, I usually say, is grossly undertold. Right? We've made significant progress.
It's only told in Lagos?
Well, I think we are not telling it enough to the world. If you look at where we are today, especially with the advent of mobile banking, digital banks, today we have the highest mobile penetration in Africa. And consequently, we're one of the highest in the world, over 80%. That's huge for a population of over 200 million people, 50% youth. You can see that the adoption of mobile for us has become a part of our lifestyle. So what that means, and we're also seeing an increasing adoption of smartphones. I think when you have a phone, the propensity to get included becomes absolutely high. Some of these people you are mentioning, most of them have accounts today. You know, but they have bank accounts today. Many, many. And part of the areas where you don't really see them have it, when you drill down carefully, you will see that beyond bank and bank accounts, there are infrastructure issues. If you are a fintech, you have a mobile phone, you are looking for people with mobile phone, you will definitely not get them in a place where there is no broadband or telco connectivity.
Yeah.
We still have broadband challenges in Nigeria. And I'm hoping that with the projects that are ongoing to fix that, we'll be fine. But you see, the game of digital banking, the game of the fintechs play, is driven on infrastructure. Where the infrastructure or the underlying infrastructure is not there, there is just so much you can do. You can't give a mobile app to someone who doesn't have internet or who doesn't have a telecom network. They won't use it. Will they use it on their TV? Or, you know? So we must deal with the underlying issues. But I think where these underlying infrastructures are working, most of these people have been able to sort themselves one way or the other. It's either you are with a wallet, you are with a digital bank account, you are with a proper bank account. So then that's where we begin to look at financial inclusion beyond bank accounts. Financial inclusion actually cuts across insurance. It covers pensions. Yeah. It covers lending. All right. So when we begin to look at all these things as one form of embedded financial services, then we can see financial inclusion in its true sense. Right. So because we've narrowed it over time to counting bank accounts.
Yeah.
Now we've counted so many bank accounts, but we'll still see that there are still cases of exclusion because we are not counting the other accompanying services or solutions that will make it wholesome. So I think a lot is happening now policy-wise. A lot is happening execution-wise.
Yeah.
So it will be much more better. But we are doing quite a lot in terms of progress as a country.
Zest payment. Let's talk about... your foray into Zest payment, what was your career trajectory like? What was it like being a construction engineer, pivoting into banking, a young banker full of ideas? How did you win boards to be able to give you that operational independence to be able to operate and run a subsidiary as massive as Zest Payment, and to talk about the relationship.
So Zest Payment from, is still a startup.
Yeah,
but I'll tell you about Johnny's.
Yeah,
my first startup experience was exactly would be 15 years, and that was when mobile money was just being introduced. So I got the opportunity to co-found one of the first mobile money companies, the first 16 licenses in Nigeria, then in 40s, and were able to set up something very good.
What's the name?
40s, the 40s Mobile Money.
Okay,
and
40s.
I became the pioneer COO then.
Wow.
Part of what we did was, how do we solve specific problems? It wasn't just about wallets. So we came up with the mobile microfinance bit, did a lot of things, got the EFINA grant, a lot of things actually. And then we were determined to focus more on the nuts. That's what you don't find very common.
Very true.
It was heavy up north, and up till today, that company still handles most of the payments, even the government payments in the north. So that was my first startup experience in mobile money. And I think I'm
one of... That was a bold move. Why did you choose the north?
Yeah, so I have a passion for the north. I grew up in the north. Okay, so... And
what part of the north?
I was born in Kaduna. I lived over 24 years there. Started my career in Kano and Katsina down to Abuja. So it's been a journey around the north. So yeah. I have a different kind of passion for the north, of course, but Nigeria in general. But you know, whenever we talk of inclusion, they say, oh, the problem is bigger in the north.
Yeah.
So some of us have been able to cut our teeth in the north. So when we talk about it, we understand the challenges. We know that if the economics are right, we will get some of these things well. Well, you know, moving...
I just want to ask you something very fundamental. What is the relationship of the Northerners with money? I can tell you what it is here in the southern part of the country. And you have dealt with these guys. You have their, you know their behavioral pattern. You know their psychology when it comes to money. If you see an Igbo man, you know the relationship an Igbo man has with his money. It's like romantic. It's like you can't part away with his money. Okay, you have 10 naira balance. It means a lot to him. What is it? What's the relationship of an average northerner with their money? Because money has a lot to do with trust. It's a part of your life. So just explain that.
You
part.
Took the word from me. Yeah. It's just one word: trust. Okay, so the average northerner, you know, one of the key ingredients for especially digital payment is trust. So the easiest place to actually drive it is in the north, because the average northerner deal with you first with trust as an underlying principle. They are happy to give you money and not wait for the receipt because they trust that you will do what is right. It's much more easier to get them to adopt this. And so trust is the key answer there. You know, and when we talk about adoption of technology and a couple of things, most of the things that we think that could not happen in the north is happening.
Like what?
Like having fintech startups in the north and all that. We now have very good fintech startups in the north. We have very good technology incubators in the north. So a lot can happen in the north. So some of those things were just more of a myth. So I think that with deliberate focus on the region,
yeah,
we can actually get it right with inclusion there. And that will speak to the overall data in the country. You know, so talking about my journey,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
From mobile money down into digital payments, and I've had that Africa experience twice, from Standard Chartered to Ecobank, and where I've had to support payments across Africa.
Yeah.
Mostly in four languages: English, French, Spanish, Portuguese.
You speak all of them?
I don't. But I've worked with stakeholders.
Wow.
So at those times you need to work with an interpreter, right? So,
very true.
But it's quite interesting, because the experience from one space to another, even as you move within Africa, is very wide. So it calls on us to see how we can unify some of these expectations to really help us achieve a better experience across Africa. Of course, then moving into big tech and now into Zest, which you are talking about. Zest is still pretty young.
Yeah,
we went live October 2023. So last year was our first full year of operations. But we've done quite a lot. And the mission crystallizing for Zest was very simple. You know, how can we make payments for businesses, B2B, B2C, and consumer payment, how can we make them simple as sending a text messages?
Right? Especially, a text message.
Yeah, especially when you witness firsthand how payment friction kills the dreams of businesses, how small traders cannot keep customers because they cannot really get good services from digital. You know, so building Zest for us was something that we thought could be a unique orchestration opportunity, especially being born out of Stanbic IBTC.
I was going to say that because the reason why I'm saying this is we saw, if you look at the NGX, Wema Bank is, I'm going to mention the brand Wema Bank. If you look at Wema Bank, you see that one of the things transforming the bank right now is their subsidiary, which is a lot. And it looks like a lot of banks are now copying. I don't want to use the word copying, but adopting that similar model where you have a subsidiary, then that subsidiary is pushing the narrative into a set of new generation, the Gen Zs and all that, and championing change. Do you think, is it similar to that?
So I think it's not really a function of copying. It's a function of the fact that we need all players' hands to be on deck. There's a lot of work to be done. Both Nigeria and Africa need payment orchestration. Not just more payment options, but we need to be able to orchestrate payments. We need to be able to orchestrate payments in a way that it reaches all the last mile, the nooks and crannies that you've been talking about. And one of the things we also need to appreciate is that most of the groups and the fintechs that have been set up most times have different strategies. There is a strategy differentiation. There is focus differentiation. Some are opening accounts. Some are driving lending. Some are powering payments for businesses. Mm-hmm. Some are powering for consumers, some lifestyle. At the end of the day, I think that when you put this as a convergence, you see that it's all for the collective good of the industry. And when you look at the problem, a typical consumer today is multi-banked. Once they have a bank account, right? And a business that is really adopting digital is juggling 6 to 8 payment providers, each with different APIs, settlement cycles, success rate. It's crazy, man. It's crazy, right? And what does the Zest solution come up with? It comes up with single integration, intelligent routing, unified payment. That is true payment orchestration. And what is the real impact? When you put in these things, what we see is a 15 to 20% improvement in transaction success rate through smart routing, right? So we're trying to look at where the pain points are, even in the existing successes that we've made, and how we can do that better. And of course, the Stanbic IBTC synergy. Stanbic IBTC has one of the oldest holdcos. So we've always been in a group structure.
Yeah, very true.
You see our leadership in pensions. You see our leadership in
investment banking
and all that. So it's phenomenal. It's interesting. So riding on the back of this very big, good leader, with very good global rating, AAA rated, you know, it gives us an opportunity to get things like a bank grade compliance, which of course is not something you find easily in the fintech space. It helps us both transform retail and corporate payments as part of our long-term strategy. And of course, we can leverage our wider network of the Standard Bank Group, which covers Africa down to Asia, to London, and the rest of them. So that ecosystem is one that we find very, very promising, both for the consumers and for the business space. And of course, because of the kind of the ecosystem that we belong to, there is that regulatory trust that we are able to, that we can do things right. And of course, that is something we do not take for granted. So we're leveraging all this to say, how do we drive orchestration? How do we drive API first for everything? How do we make payments easier? Let businesses be able to take payments the way the consumer wants to pay, right? And not decide for the consumers and thereby losing sales, losing payments. And let consumers also be able to pay the way they want to pay, right? This way, because most times we don't see payments digitization as an ecosystem. I'll give you an example. In Nigeria, we've been issuing contactless cards for over 10 years, right? But our POSs were not prepared to handle contactless cards over 10 years ago. We're just making that progress now as an industry. If at that time we were forcing contactless card into the market, we're also forcing contactless POS, thinking of it from an ecosystem approach, yeah, we would have made much more progress than we have today. But you see, we've given millions of cards. Now we are now trying to get the POSs ready from step to step. Of course, there are policy issues, there are issues around those things. But it just means that we should think first principles first. And that first principle is ecosystem. You know, so when we begin to do that, we are thinking ecosystem, we are thinking orchestration, we are thinking simplicity, we are thinking customer centricity. How do we achieve this? Not only for consumer, but for the business.
Yeah.
For the businesses and for the large corporate, for government. How do we ensure we bring all these people together so that wherever they meet, they can easily do business together? And every business always terminates with payment.
45% in the first half of 2025, 45% of capital that came into Africa came into fintech. 45%. And I mean, if you look at the African business landscape, globally, we have 11 sectors. And fintech is just a subsector of one. 45% of capital that came into fintech. And that is at the expense of agriculture. That is at the expense of education. It's at the expense of entertainment. It's at the expense of, you mentioned the industry, healthcare. What is it about fintech? Have we not solved the financial inclusion issue? If we've not solved it, what can be done to solve it? One. Secondly, how can we evenly, I don't want to say evenly distribute capital, but it looks like that's what I'm going to end up saying. How can we evenly distribute capital to other sectors so that one is not thriving at the expense of other? Because if we have all the payment gateways, the agricultural sector is down, healthcare is down, we're not going to make a lot of money as we think. Purchasing power depleting by the day because we don't have the infrastructure to power other industries. Why? Let's talk about that.
Okay, thank you. I think I'll start by saying that I personally do not believe that the funds are competing. I do not think that fintechs are taking funds at the expense of healthcare.
If you're VC now, where will you put your money?
So, VC. That's where I want to land.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of thinking that fintech is all about payments is not really the wholesome representation of fintechs, right? Today we are seeing mobility tech becoming unicorn, expecting an announcement soon. We've seen
health. You're hearing that for the first time here.
We're seeing health tech.
Yeah.
We're seeing prop tech. We're seeing land tech. We're seeing wealth tech. These are all ecosystems that are not just payments. So some of these investments in VCs that are all classified under fintech, some of them have gone into investment space. Some of them have gone into property tech. Some of them have gone into health tech. Yes, health tech. So while you say at the expense of health, I want to remind you that there are health tech investment by VCs that have now given ability for people to sit in their house and assess telemedicine.
Yeah.
And assess medical personnel across 50, 200 countries in the world, where you have to travel to Dubai, to Saudi Arabia to get treatment. You get tele-treatment.
Yeah.
That is health, but powered by technology. So I think what the VCs have done is to also see how we are not thinking traditional. We are not thinking legacy. Okay. How do we see people? How do we fund people who are trying to use technology to drive different aspects of our lifestyles? So it means if you are traditionally in the health sector, you need to show how to do something different. That doesn't mean that we are not seeing private equity companies invest in building bigger hospitals.
Yeah.
But I think for a VC, that word venture means that you need to do something better. You need to do something new. That's what venture capital is. So if you are manufacturing, if you're doing health, you need more money. There are private equity investors and other funds you can use to do that. But if we say venture, let us venture, right? And that means that we must think of how better we can do the things we're already doing now even if we have to discard the entirety of what we are doing now and do it a whole different way to better not just now, but also future-proof the generation that are to come.
And can you stay on that a little bit before you go further? Because I need my audience to really understand. There's somebody who is a little bit confused, trying to find out what's the difference between private equity, venture capital, VC, what angel investor. Can we break down all those technical terms upcoming founders?
So I think the private equity.
Yeah.
I think the private equity, as the name implies.
Yeah.
You're getting private funds. Much more, they invest more into growth organizations that are already running. You see more around acquisitions, you see more around takeover.
Okay.
Ventures are investing in ventures. It's more long term, right? And newer, while the angels are more around the seed, the earlier stage, right? Yeah. So different stages, different kind of. So, of course, if you are today, let's say you are a school, let's say the government wants to borrow money.
Yeah.
And they go for PPP. If you are a big business, like a conglomerate, you don't go for venture capital. You've been operating for 50 years. You look for private equity funds. You look for other forms of investments, right? So that's how it should work.
Okay.
Well, if you're starting a venture, if you have a young venture that's maybe a decade old, you've been able to show how you can create long-term value, right? So VCs will give you money and they will work with you through that process of growth. Of course, the angels are there even at the seeding to even fund your concept, to even fund how you are able to put prototypes together and help you get started before you even start getting VCs.
Yeah.
You know, so, and at some point, some other people bootstrap. And somehow we're not talking enough around people that bootstrap. We see a lot of founders bootstrap with their own money, without anybody's fund, and they still get to that level, build to a level before they even start asking for funds. So whichever way, one thing is good about what you said.
Yeah.
Whether it's coming to health, to fintechs, to anywhere, we need foreign direct investment as a country. Now, how we make it go to different sectors and any, those sectors have to show the potentials. We have to continue to also deal with the underlying factors. There must be trust. There must be progress. There must be innovation. Okay. Because we don't just throw, the VCs will not just throw funds because you asked. There must be a pitch that is worth it. It must be economically viable, right? It must be solving a problem,
yeah.
Right? So when those things are there, then the conversation is easier. So I think sectors that feel they are not getting enough needs to do more to get enough. But when you also talk about the capital allocation problem, which you talked about, which you raised earlier, I think one of the core issue is that capitals are chasing revenue. Most of the capital we are seeing today is chasing revenue. It's not building sustainable infrastructure. So,
but would you blame them if you were, if you're a VC and say you get, you have access to pool of funds, which is how the system works, and you to allocate capital to any startup founder or something, what would you rather do? Wouldn't you want a penny on every pound you invest? Wouldn't you want a cobble on any naira you invest?
So
wouldn't you be thinking of return on investment?
When you build sustainable infrastructure,
yeah,
you will also get return on investment, but maybe not as quicker as you expect. But you see, that's
also, so you're saying we don't have patient capital?
Yes, there is a bit not enough patient capital. And part of what I think, this is my view though,
yeah.
Part of what I also think is that we've chased a lot of concepts, initiatives. We've done so many projections on revenues. But we've also seen that one of the key factors that have affected the growth and the growth acceleration is the absence of sustainable infrastructure. So we need to put our money in the area of greatest priority. So we need to also deal with the short-term thinking. We don't want VCs to demand quicker exits. Okay. There should be financial infrastructure then that will come with patient capital. You understand? We also don't want to just import the Silicon Valley playbook to African markets, right? Of course, a lot of adaptation here.
You think that's a major problem in your sector? Because it looks like that is it. We just import the Silicon Valley system and template want it to work.
I think it's in part and part, and that's where getting to understand the market is very important, right? For some, it has worked. Okay. Some people say, I don't think there's anything wrong with the playbook, but the truth is that we must be able to carefully evaluate. If you're investing in a health tech, what is it? If you are investing in agri tech, what is it? The gestation period, even the time to deliver value to the consumer is different. So we must look at that thing. Maybe we should check the templates again, right? And of course, the ecosystem fragmentation where you have so many startups building the same basic thing. Okay. So maybe a bit more of diversification, which we're already beginning to see at this time. But when we look at all that and we deal with it carefully, we're going to see a more fairer distribution and maybe also getting to have domestic or local investors, right? Getting to invest too, because charity begins at home.
You think we don't have enough investors?
We're beginning local.
Yeah, local investors.
Of course, we can do better.
Remember the state of the Naira?
Yes. Maybe we should be having Naira investments too. Because part of the problem is having dollar investments and earning in Naira.
So you think it's a fundamental problem. And if we can reverse engineer the entire process, it'll make a lot more sense.
It's very difficult for a fintech startup that takes, whether it's fund in debt, equity, or in whatever, and you take these things in dollars and you have to earn in Naira. And most times the fee you earn is regulated.
Very true.
It's very, 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 very difficult. So when most times we talk about startup shutdown, when you look at the burn rates for some startups, it's real. It's not because the founders are reckless.
But there are so many, not being general.
Trying to tell you that burnout is real, right? Because when you see the cost of cloud infrastructure, when you see the cost of having to retain the best talent, when you see the cost of having to commercialize your concept, it comes with money. Okay. So, and there was someone was talking to me jokingly and said, maybe most of those people who burn out faster. That was maybe about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
The conversation was, maybe the people who burn out faster were people who requested for $2 million or three. If you request for 100, you can stay longer. But I think over time, that's not true because we're also seeing larger investments, fintechs with larger investments still pack up. But it's not a problem for you to pack up. To be honest, not all ventures should be successful. But when you do it, you should be able to do your pack up transparently. Those are the views, right? So I don't know why we think that ventures not continuing or startups saying, okay, we need to pivot is a sign of just failure. But it's a part of learning, right? It's a venture. So you venture into something, you gauge success at every stage. And if you need to take steps back, you should take steps back. Just do it very transparently. And the more we begin to accommodate this fintechs having to pivot, having to step down, then we will see more transparency in the ecosystem because people will now be able to tell you, I'm not able to continue with this, okay? Mm. Because they know you're not going to put their head on the chopping block, right? So I think we'll need a bit more objectivity and transparency to be able to manage the venture success as we progress.
What is the perfect African playbook for a startup founder? What do you think is the perfect playbook? You mentioned we overflow in Silicon Valley and it's not working. So what do you think works? Do you have a template? Do you have a startup that have done it that we can always model and use it as a template?
So, I won't say that I have a template.
Okay.
But I'll just say this, about how we can address some of these things.
Yeah.
Right. If you look at talking about VCs and funding African startups, you know, we should look more about, around the longer investment horizons, right? At least 7 to 10 year hold. Not
that's your definition of long.
Longer.
Okay.
Not compared to the 3 to 5 years we're looking at now.
Okay.
I think every business you speak to, everybody wants to say, where do you see it in 3 to 5 years? Maybe we should change the question to where do you see it in 7 to 10 years?
Hmm.
That's what longer means, right? Then of course, in terms of the infrastructure focus, that is also very important, right? How do we fund those boring but critical back-end systems? It's not every time you want to fund an app. So let me give you. The reality today is that 80% of funding has gone into user-facing apps. 20% has gone to infrastructure needed reality, right? Sometimes, but you know, sorry, into infrastructure. And part of what we need is to see how 60% can fund infrastructure, 40% funding applications. Because you cannot put something on nothing and expect it to stand. You understand?
Yeah.
So how do we focus now on funding those boring but critical back-end systems?
Like which ones?
Everything. Everything from the processing.
Hmm.
And I'll give you an example.
Please do.
So when you talk about critical back-end system, how do we fund ecosystem back ends for open banking? How do we fund for API hosting, for cybersecurity, shared solutions for cybersecurity? Because some of these things are things that startups on their own cannot afford individually. We need to build an ecosystem that is working for Nigeria. So where is our centralized cybersecurity infrastructure? How are the VCs supporting the open banking rollout in Nigeria? How are we supporting virtual currency and all those infrastructure? Even the AI for you, because everybody keeps talking about AI is going to do this miracle. Do you know the infrastructure you need to run some of these AI solutions? Why are we not funding that infrastructure in Africa, in Nigeria?
Man, we never chop. You think saying go reason AI? You think that? So I'm saying this because
the myth is that
let me give you a classic example. There was a tweet that went viral, and if you look at the Nigerian business landscape, it looks like starting the startup ecosystem. It looks like we want to short circuit or jump the gun in proffering solutions. Manufacturing is the bedrock of the second industrial revolution. And we're skipping manufacturing. We want to go into the fourth industrial revolution, which is tech and digitalization. What do you think? Do you think we can skip it and be successful as a nation? You made mention of infrastructure. What is happening to manufacturing and all that? If we start investing in AI, do you think that that's the right thing to do?
So the question is, what does manufacturing mean? And I'll tell you.
Yeah.
All what we are saying still boils down to longer investment horizons. I don't think it's about a man when he watch up. It's not about hunger. It's about having that longer span. Like I said, we need to change. Where do you see yourself in 3 to 5 years? To where do you see yourself in 7 to 10 years? Because for a man who wants to see something good in 3 years, you have no choice but to take the fastest route. But sometimes the fastest route might not be the most sustainable route. You get what I'm trying to
say? Absolutely.
Let me give you an example when we talk about infrastructure. Today, we've seen fintechs roll out millions of POS over the last 5 years. In fact, the growth is exponential. How many of those POSs were produced in Nigeria? We now have 80% mobile phones penetration in Nigeria. I know some phones are assembled, some produced in Nigeria, but the question is, even in this room, how many of us are using a made in Nigeria phone? Right? But these are all tools for the financial and the digital innovation you are talking about.
Yeah.
How many fintechs are using local, made, hosted, or cloud Nigerian services. Cloud platforms? Right? How many of us are using Nigerian produce local software? Right? We saw recently one of our banks going to Nigerian built core banking. Applaudable. But that is one out of 30. We need to start dealing with fundamentals. We are talking too much from the top. Right? We need to go to the basics. Right? When some of these investments start touching on the infrastructure, having to build on those infrastructure will even require lesser investment. That's the simple economics, right? We're investing so much on the top. We need a bit more into investing in those critical back-end systems, into investing in the hardwares, into investing in the imagine hosting AI, imagine having that infrastructure that can power open banking for Nigeria. Imagine doing a lot of things. What if we invest in these places? These are infrastructures that can run us for the next 10 to 15 years. We can continue to innovate at the top, but the underlying infrastructure will still be very useful. You get, so when we say focus on that infrastructure, that is what it means. That is what it means.
What is open banking? We just assume a lot of people understand. Oh, what is the concept of
what
open banking?
What if I don't understand? So I think the whole concept of open banking is that we now have institutions being able to connect to each other via APIs. What I say to my friends and colleagues is that we're already doing open banking. But the difference in having an industry-driven open banking is that we can bring in standardization. Today, if Bank A connects to Bank B, what you see in the API and the interaction is different from when Bank C is connecting to Bank B, right? There's just a lot of nuance in terms of how we have to tweak and tweak and tweak. We think the open banking is going to standardize that. So with the idea of APIs and the registries, we think that it's going to open up diverse services, financial services to consumers on a need basis. What you want, you can get instead of pushing everything to you. And we think it gives an opportunity to institutions that have built innovative solutions to be able to also give it out to other institutions. So you don't have to build everything. So if I want to offer lending services and you have it already, I just take these services from you when you are there on the open banking exchange. You know, so this is where we should be going to. And that's part of what ecosystem solutioning does.
Yeah,
it lowers the cost to deploy, consequently lowers the cost to serve the customer. And of course, when you, everything in terms of cost lower, even the kind of investment and the burn will reduce.
Very true.
Right. So we need to deal with these things from the basics.
This is an opportunity to ask the long awaited question. So what I do is that I find out from our community what they love me to ask. And this is it. If I pick up my phone right now and I try to do a transaction from one of what's the most popular, let's say from Opay to Moneypoint. These two guys are unicorns. If I pick up my phone and I open Moneypoint app and I send to you right now, before I say the word right now, you've gotten the alert. And if somebody else does it, and it was like a magic to the rural part of the country. That's why you saw huge adoption. If I'm doing a transaction between GT to First or even Stanbic IBTC, it's not as swift and as fast as some of all these other banks, new generation banks and mobile money operators. That's the license they have. What is the tech behind, what is the infrastructure behind that SWIFT service? Why is it so? A lot of people need to understand. These banks have been for decades where we have these MMOs or mobile money operators just coming in and transforming the way we transact at the speed of light. Can you shed some light on that?
So I know that there are some things I will not be authorized to speak here, but regarding this, but I'll just give you a background. I think it's not just about
you can speak in parables. We accept it.
So it's not just about superiority of technology. It's also because when you look at the technologies, of course, the investment in cybersecurity, investment in biometrics, investment in mobile apps. If you look at the books and you see what even traditional banks invest in technology, I don't think there are fintechs that can match it. Most of them in billions, yeah.
Hmm.
So beyond looking at the technology and what it is, we also need to look at different things. The dynamics of routing transactions and a few other things that I might not want to talk about because of players that are involved, right? But sometimes the routes determines the speed, right? And there are some of that.
What is the route for MMOs? What is the route for traditional?
So that's the point. So it's not different, but when you are innovating today, there are some things you're doing that will take some time before a traditional bank will follow that route. Because, again, the level of compliance in traditional banks is DNA inbuilt. So the level of cautiousness is a bit higher, right? So even though we've seen banks, like if you see the Stanbic IBTC Ability, we just announced it 2 days ago. That mobile app is made in heaven, right? And really, I am personally proud of it, you know. But when you look at it, someone will still tell you, oh, in seconds. But we've built it to the highest grade of compliance. So if you test it in any way you want to test it, regulatory wise, you'll see that it's compliant, right? In terms of how we flow and how we solve the customers and processing and fulfillment, we try to be very compliant and we continue to be innovative, right? So I think at some point we should also see that whether you're a fintech, you're an MMO, some of the new entrants have also taken different paths in trying to innovate. And that's why we are here. That's why Stanbic IBTC also has Zest, right? So some of the things you're talking about, we have them in Zest, right? So we are innovating via different paths, and we just think that it's going to be for the collective good of the ecosystem.
Do you think fintechs are going to obliterate traditional banks at some point?
It's not true. They've been saying that thing for over 15 years now, or 10 years. There was a time when every time you go to event, they'll say how fintech will kill banks. Then another one will be holding in the other room how banks will quench the fintech. It's not true. It's never going to happen.
Why?
So I'll tell you why. Even the way the ecosystem is structured today, I'm not sure there is any fintech that is processing payments today without a bank. Then there is also no bank that can tell us that they are not using a technology, at least one technology that is developed by a fintech. So this complementarity is not something you can take for granted. Why do fintech operate with banks? You need a bank to sponsor you, even before you can process global card schemes. You need a bank to settle your transactions. You need a bank to do so many things for you as a payment facilitator. So we'll begin to see that every player in the ecosystem has a role to play. They are not necessarily out there to strangle the other. But in terms of market share, have we seen traditional banks? New banks, because they're also classifying them under fintechs, right? Taking some shares from the traditional. The answer is yes.
Exactly.
But don't forget, there are also licensed banks. those fintechs are licensed banks, like the traditional bank. So it's a bank against bank. But when you take a pure payment fintech, a pure payment fintech does not do banking, right?
True.
So there is never a time they will operate without a bank. But if I am one of the new banks you have called, I open an account, you open an account, we are competing. Okay, so it's about who gives the highest value. But if I am not opening an account and I'm processing payments and you are a bank, you need me to process payments. I also need you to settle. So there is this symbiotic relationship that you cannot rule out. So I know, and that's why I keep telling you that the fintech space is vast, it's diverse. There are the deposit money banks that are operating digitally. There are the digital lenders. Those ones are also competing with banks when it comes to
those
lending.
Those ones are even crazy entirely because their rates are...
Yeah. They are the investment guys. They are the... So wealth guys. So even when you go to the asset management sector, people keep talking about bank.
Mm.
But we'll see fintechs that have taken significant market share in terms of money market, all these asset management products from traditional asset management companies. Right? These are head-ons.
The likes of Carrywise, Bamboo, and all that. That's what
So you know what I mean. But we have to look at what do they do. There is that area of complementarity. There is that area of competition. If I'm doing the same thing that you are doing, we are competing. So we have to do better. That's what it means.
If you... It's very important for us to have that conversation. Because if we look at what happened in... I would just love to draw an insight from comedy. You see what the skit makers are doing with stand-up comedy. Stand-up comedy is no more a thing. And now skit makers are the ones frontlining the entertainment form of comedy.
There was still AY Live in December and there was traffic in Echo Hotel. Who were those people?
But what I'm saying is, if I get your point, but you will see that the market is shifting. The market is shifting. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let us talk about alternative payment. And payment is sending money from me to you. Whether globally, whether nationally, payment is payment. I'm sending money sending value from me to you. And fintech is riding on the wave of tech, which is tech infrastructure that enables payment from party A to party B. Cryptocurrency is global.
Mm.
It's like you have a tree right in front of your house,
mm-hmm.
and you claim you have one of the highest structure, and somebody comes to build a telecom mast.
Mm-hmm.
There's no tree that I know of. Mm-hmm. That's as tall as the telecom mast. And it looks like it's beginning to shake the payment ecosystem globally. I'm not even talking of Nigeria now. The reason is, so I would rather, I've done it a couple of times. I want to make payment from here to the UK or to the US and say I want to pay my producer, fantastic man, Adebisi Peters. And I want to send him some money. And I tell him, send me your wallet address.
Mm-hmm.
He's in the UK or in the US. Send me your wallet address. In seconds, he's going to get it. And this is me boycotting CBN. I'm boycotting Security and Exchange Commission. I'm boycotting the Feds in the US. I'm boycotting all those protocols, all those regulators straight to the next party without any third party intervention. Do you think this will collapse the ecosystem? Do you think
So I don't think you boycotted them.
Okay.
Because those transactions will be reported.
You sure?
Yeah.
It's decentralized. Especially for countries
you're talking of regulated cryptocurrency. Yes. Okay, where it's regulated, it will be reported, right? Yeah. So, but I think the word boycotts is... It's a bit worrisome. Okay, so if a regulator hears that now, they'll be worried, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's about boycott. It is about how the ecosystem is designed to operate, right? Of course, you've been identified, and all that. You're on the chain, and before you're able to do that transaction, and we've seen Nigeria is ranking second highest in terms of cryptocurrency in the world.
Adoption,
there is a reason. It's our demography.
Yeah, very true.
You know, and no matter how much you try to regulate the cryptocurrency, you will just find out that the young people will always find a way to solve their problem. Okay, the French call it System D. You know, there is always a way out. They'll look for a way out. But of course, that further emphasizes the need people have to move money from one place to another. Right? So send me your ID. We move money and we do some of these things. One thing I always look at as an individual is that there is still that point where money moves from traditional institution into the chain. Okay. I don't think the blockchain or crypto has branches where you go to pay money. It moves from traditional institution into the chain. And unless you are exchanging those coins or currencies for value, if you still need to fall back to fiat, you would interface with a traditional institution that is subject to those stringent regulation. So I think that the cryptocurrency will continue to thrive because of the needs and use cases.
Yeah.
What we also hope to see more is countries across Africa rolling out their digital currencies so that we do less with paper money. And also get coming up with our stable coins.
Yeah.
So that we can do more and play in the global space. We should give this whole form factors an opportunity to play out themselves. So that we don't oversweat them. If we have 54 digital currencies in Africa today, the noise around cryptocurrency will be different.
Very true.
So the landscape, let's allow these form factors to play out and see what happens to them. So I don't think it's a case of boycott. It's a case of, it's an ecosystem. When you are inside the chain and inside the ecosystem, you do everything you want to do. It might look closed, but once you are crossing out of it, you will interface with someone that is regulated.
Very true.
The ecosystem is just there, right? Money will keep moving one way or the other. Before it gets to the last mile, it's something will touch it that can be seen.
Very true. So you, as the president of the FinTech Association of Nigeria, by the way, congratulations. It's still good to congratulate you. And you said you have that's why we had some meat pie before the show, because you have a pie agenda.
Ah, okay. That was a setup.
That's what you called
it. I was wondering why they gave me meat pie.
Yeah, it was because you said you have a pie agenda.
Absolutely.
And for you to come up with that, it means you're passionate with meat pie or something. And it has to do with participation, innovation, and an expansion, which is a phenomenal one. But I really want to break it down as an ecosystem stakeholder, a young man, young startup founder who's trying to build a product in the fintech ecosystem. There are a lot of gatekeepers. You're one of them. I'll put it that way. And as a gatekeeper, it looks like the wall is too high. The barrier is so high. Where would a forward-thinking startup founder get 100 million to pay as license fees? To the SEC, if the SEC are your regulators, you need to pay to the SEC or even the CBN. What are the, number one, I'm going to break down the question into what are the certifications you need to get? What are the licenses you need to get? What are the T's and the I's you need to dot and cross before you become a fintech startup in Nigeria as at today?
Okay, so I'll be very cautious in answering that. And I'll be cautious in answering that.
Yeah.
And I'll take it from two perspectives.
Okay.
First, I'll start with a question to you.
Yeah.
Let me host the podcast now.
Right. All right.
Right? So, would you put your money in a bank that doesn't have money?
No, I won't.
Perfect. So if you're a startup you want to touch payment, you want to hold customers' funds.
Yeah.
Part of why we have those license shareholders deposits and all that, I'm not a regulator.
Yeah.
I'm not holding forth for the regulator.
Very true.
But part of why we have those things is because this, the business of financial services is first built on trust, then capacity. Capacity. Someone who has not shown that they can own 100 million should not collect 100 million from you to keep. Right? It's as simple as ABC. So when we say you go to SEC and you need 150 million to get an assets management license, or you go to CBN and you need 100 million to take a PSP. By the way, you are not paying this money. These monies get returned to you. Because that's what most people don't talk about. So when you pay 100 million to get a payment license and you go through the process, the CBN returns this money to you with interest. I'm not sure the public is being told that.
When? For how long? How long?
Once your licensing process is complete and you get your license, they immediately refund your money to you. Right? And I'm surprised that this is not being told to the public. But the point is this. Why do I need to drop that money? You are trying to show that you are capable. Yeah, you can't just come, like you said, man, we never chop. Is that not what you said? Yeah. Man, we never chop. You want to keep people money. Is it not that you will chop the money? You understand what I'm trying to say?
Absolutely.
So I don't have any issue. If you want to be a financial institution, a payment processor,
yeah,
you should demonstrate capacity. Honestly, it's part of the problem we have today. When you begin to have fintech startups that don't have capacity, then we are building, we'll have a chaotic ecosystem.
Very true.
It's not only for licensing. You need money to be PCI DSS certified. You need money to be ISO certified. You need money to set up cloud infrastructure. You need money to do compliance. You need money to do a lot of things. You need money to pay people.
Can we take it again and give us the average? What do you need? You need money for the license. You've mentioned 100 million to 150. What's the next one?
It's not a fee, right? Yeah. Even for the license, when you're putting your shareholders fund down,
yeah,
part of what you need to do is to also get the infrastructure. You need to build a platform that you can demonstrate to the regulator that you can do it. You will show them, yeah, it works. You need a lot of money to set it up. So if you're setting up something like that, honestly, I can't give an actual figure, but I think depending on the use case or the problem you are trying to solve,
yeah,
you need money. If you're not having more than $1 million or that amount, you're not necessarily going to get off the ground. Or 2 million, you know, depending on what you're trying to solve, like I said.
Yeah.
Because 100 million is just for payments. Well, some startups say, I want to be a switch. Your shareholder fund for being a switch is 2 billion. You understand? So it depends on what you are trying to do. There is no clear cut amount. But what it is, my advice to startups or could be founders is that you should get deeper understanding of what you really want to get. Scope the requirements very well before you proceed on the journey. Why am I saying this? I've seen some founders accost me on the road or at events, meet me up and say, I want to have a word with you. And we stop, have a brief chat. And they say to me, I've built this solution. I want to do this. I've approached this bank to partner with me, but they say I must bring a license. Eh? You are a founder. You built a solution for 2 years. You didn't know you need a license. You understand what I'm trying to say?
True.
So, but these are as funny as it is. This, yeah, I'm telling you, me, not a story. It has happened to me more than 6 times. Different people. So these are like 6 different founders that have spent between 6 months to 2 years building solution. After taking it out to commercialize, they tell them, boy, you needed a license to even think of this. Then they are stuck. They've invested. They've built, then eventually they don't know where to go forward or backward. So the first thing is to get an understanding of the ecosystem you are going to. There is no one as dangerous as trying to be a driver in a car you don't understand. You understand what I'm trying to say? So you must understand the ecosystem that you are going into. You must know if you need a license, what kind of license do you need?
So that means there's no way for Lapo babies. That's what you're saying.
No.
Wait, I want to break it down. 77,000 naira is the minimum wage. I know that, let's not even talk about minimum wage, but what is the average salary? 250 million.
Mm-hmm.
You have a brilliant idea that's going to revolutionize the payment ecosystem. But where you want to see 100 million?
Be an entrepreneur, be an employee. Every Nigerian should not be a founder. You must grow from somewhere, right? Yeah. I usually say to people, today at Zest, I am a co-founder that is not an owner. Right? Yeah, because of course, I'm a co-founder. My bosses are the founders.
Yeah.
But I'm a co-founder having to do this with life and blood for the past few years, right? But I'm not an owner. So if tomorrow I become a founder and an owner, right? I have worked for people. I have gained lessons, learnings, right? You don't have to be a founder the day after your degree or NYSC. That's where sometimes we are getting it wrong. Okay, we think that the idea of being a founder is just for you to come out of school, first class, dreadlocks, 21 years. No.
Why did you add that dreadlock?
Dreadlock because I'm jealous. I have bad head. You know?
Yeah, I get it.
My hair is getting bald. So I can't have dreadlock. Yeah, you want to criticize what you don't have. So,
yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
That's not it.
Hmm.
If you have an idea and you don't have the money and you don't have the means to finance it.
Yeah.
Sometimes we see people just go bootstrap. Do you know how many founders in quote and unquote that I interview every day for employment? So we're talking frankly now, right?
Yeah.
Do you know how many founders I interview? And most times I'm very interested and I really want to know the story. Why do you want to suddenly work? Some of them have spent 2 years trying to build something. I admire that so much.
Yeah.
But sometimes I felt you should have just gotten a job while you build your concept. That way you even have a clearer head. And I am not in any way downplaying the effort of those who have bootstrapped their way to success.
Very true.
But not everybody will be a founder. Okay? Not everybody. While great organizations are busy looking for talent, they will pay very well.
Yeah.
They don't want to look for job. Everybody wants to be a founder.
Yeah.
That great initiative you have, if you take it into a big institution, and you will be shocked how they will reshape it. And when it comes back, nobody can take your idea from you. If it is originally yours, you'll be shocked how it turns 360 and solves even problems that you could not imagine.
Very true.
From the onset. So let's not just think that even me, I have idea now. Don't you have idea? You know, so it's not every time you have an idea, you have to become a founder.
Very true.
Right? Try to build the learning. And I think that learning, mentorship is very key. It's something that I see a lot more happening now in the space, but maybe a few years back, it's lacking in some of the cases.
So we seldom see exits and merger and acquisition. It's something that is common amongst traditional banks, but we're not seeing fintechs take their routes rather than shutting down merger. When you've made a lot of money and you become a unicorn and you know you've capped something, why don't you just exit? And you enter other parts of the world. We're seeing Paystack, I think Flutterwave did that with Stripe, either Flutterwave or Paystack with Stripe. And it was great. I don't acquisition. Okay, so, what's your take about that?
So I think that there are a few acquisitions, mergers in the fintech space. What I've seen is that it doesn't really get the media publicity as much as we give to VC investments and all that. And I like the story you've given about Paystack and Stripe. Quite an interesting one.
Mm.
So for me, Paystack, Stripe acquisition or investment, I don't know what it is now, but I don't think it was an exit, right? I think for me, it's beyond the money and the investment. It's about the fact that a Nigerian born fintech. I don't know if he's Nigerian born now.
Yeah.
Yeah, because again,
yeah,
you know why. But it's a fintech of Nigerian descent, is able to partner with a global player like Stripe.
Yeah.
What that gives you is they are now able to operate at a much higher standard. They are able to align in terms of infrastructure, in terms of product delivery, solution delivery.
Mm.
It takes them up to a whole different level.
Very true.
Right. And to me, that's more commendable. They are able to get exposed to the expertise, leadership expertise at Stripe, which is a much more bigger company.
Very true.
And these are quite critical. Those are part of the things we should also be looking out for in investment, beyond just taking money and trying to build by yourself.
Yeah.
How much of support are you going to get, synergy from your investor? And I think that's what the Paystack Stripe partnership really, that's what excites me most about it.
Well, rounding off now, what's the future of fintech in Africa? Future of fintech. What do you think we should be looking out for?
In what area?
General payments. We even talk about loans and all those loan sharks, but there's no time for that. Those guys are criminals. I'm going to put it that way.
They are doing business, right?
Do you think it's business?
Do you work for FCCPC?
Yeah. Okay.
They are doing business. So, but in terms of my closing thoughts, we're in 2025. I'll try to look at what 2030 should mean for the Africa payment vision. So we're trying not to ever go beyond 5 years, because 5 years is a long time in payment.
Yeah.
You know, for Africa, I think we should be able to see universal digital payment. We need every transaction to be capable of being digital. We need to go digital.
Intra-Africa.
So we need to see seamless cross-border commerce.
Do you think the AFCTA is adding to that?
Well, beyond AFCTA, perhaps we've seen so many things happening. But you see, the trade friction that we have is high, and we need it to slide down to zero.
Zero.
As we go to 2030. Why am I saying so? If you look at Nigeria and you just go next door to Benin Republic or to Togo, even though we are geographically very close, financially, payment-wise,
far apart.
Like, we're like Nigeria and US. You know, so we need that gap to be closed. That friction needs to go down to zero. Embedded financial services should take scale. The finance component, like I said, every business transaction ends with a payment. But where we should be going is that the finance component should be invisible, but omnipresent.
True.
It will always be there.
Very true.
But let us not always start with the payment first. Let us start with the use cases, whether you are delivering health, whether you are lending, whether you are investing, whether you are doing education services. Let that era of payment be invisible but omnipresent, right? It will always be there.
True.
So because that's why people always think payment. But there is a lot more in terms of ecosystem digitization. And of course, inclusive economic participation. So we don't want to just include and digitize in the urban areas alone. We need to go into the rural areas. That imbalance is something that needs to be addressed, not just in Nigeria, but across Africa. Because even if you go to other African countries, the dynamics is very similar.
True.
The rural areas going to through a lot. So for the industry, you know, like we said, we need to start collaborating on standards. We need to do more on infrastructure.
That's right.
For regulators, we need to enable innovation while we are protecting consumers and also the operators and their investment, right? For investors, we need to, back to that thing, you know, fund the boring critical infrastructure. That one is very important, right? So generally, We need to start seeing payment, not just as building system, one new startup, everybody startup, one new payment channels. Payment business, fintech business as it is now, is a generational responsibility. You are not building for yourself. You have to make sure that payment is easier for your children and for your children's children and transformed. What would you say you achieved in the next 50 years by God's grace if we are here? You know, we have to say something, right? Just like you are reading about Einstein and all those people, what would you have achieved? It will not be good if we keep talking about this payment and not break that ice. Thank you.
Stanley Jacob, Dr. Stanley Jacob. Before I round off, we have a culture of suggesting you're going to ask the person a question and you're going to suggest who you want on our famous couch. Tell us about a founder you want to see on our famous couch and ask the person a question. When he comes, we'll definitely ask him that question.
Okay, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't see that coming. I wanted to think now. Ernest Obi.
Ernest Obi.
Transact World Digital Financial Services.
What question do you have for him?
Since we've been talking about founders and drive, I want us to ask Ernest Obi, what really was his drive to, what drove him to setting up Transact World and that confidence that he got from the beginning that he will see the success he's seeing now? It's simply amazing. We need the world to learn from that.
Ernest Obi, we have a question for you. You've heard from him, Dr. Stanley Jacob. He's saying, what is that drive? How we need to understand what your value system is. How is it that you're able to deliver this result? And I think it's to be a good thing to have you here come answer the question from Dr. Stanley Jacob. Ladies and gentlemen, that is it on the Frankly Business Podcast. It's been an amazing time talking about payment. But the beautiful thing about payment is the fact that it powers all other industry, from healthcare to agriculture to government, to everything you can even think of. Payment is the bedrock of every business because we need to transact. And I love the fact that you ended it with talking about how we can transact, have borderless transactions amongst our African brothers and sisters, because we're talking about the AFCTA and all that. Enough of transacting with my fellow Nigerians. I need to also transact with my fellow South Africans doing amazing stuff. People from Benin Republic, people from Ghana doing great stuff. And I even love the payment system from Ghana, Momo. It looks like it has not penetrated into our market. Anyways, that is it from us on the Frankly Business Podcast. Amazing, amazing time with Dr. Stanley Jacob. Thank you very much for coming to the Frankly Business Podcast. It's a honor. Thank you very much. Thank you. And thank you to my producers. Thank you to Narametric Studios. This was brought to you, courtesy Narametric Studios, and my amazing producer, Adebisi Peters. Great guy, but one man with one pack. I love that. Anyways, I'll see you on the next episode. Make sure you stay cool. Please make sure you like, share, subscribe. Do watch and share. Gain wisdom. This is a business school, a moving business school, digital business school, where you can gain insight from founders. I'll see you on the next episode. Cheers.